Okay, hello everybody. I now find myself in a position that nobody wants to find himself in. The last major stumbling block between you and the well-deserved coffee break. Also running late already, I'll try to be quick. I have now the pleasure to report findings from a recent paper of ours, and by recent I mean it hasn't appeared yet. And by ours I mean the list of co-authors that you see here. Specifically, I want to point out that Sarah Piotto is a co-author. Unfortunately, I forgot to include her in the list of authors that are sent together, so she's not in the abstract books. So please note Sarah Piotto. Also, most of the actual work was, of course, done by Leeson McGonigal, also from the UBC in Vancouver. And here, finally, you see a nice photograph of our home institution. I think most recognized it here. It's the Institute of Applied Systems and an International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Luxembourg in Austria. Now, if you look at this title, you may be wondering what this talk is doing in this workshop. Because you see coexistence here, which is a kind of relevant topic apparently. But you see sexual selection, which is something we haven't talked about so much. And you see a dubious claim of ecological equivalence instead of differentiation and limiting similarity and all that. So in order to give you, to provide some context and to put this talk in the context of this workshop, I will try. I will begin with some, well, you could say, semi-philosophical musings about the competitive exclusion principle, and then I will move on to having a small coexistence puzzle for you, and then I will quickly talk about the model and some explanations of that. Oh, okay, that doesn't work. About competitive exclusion. Well, sorry, I need to press this button a lot of times, so I think I must move this out of the way. This is really not a new idea, so it's a very, I mean, in layman's terms, this coexistence of similar species is unlikely. This is pointed out by Arlen in his important paper in 1960. It's not a new idea. It wasn't a new idea then. If you go back 100 years, a century from 1960, you're basically at the origin, and that is the origin of species by Darwin. And Liz Pastor yesterday has given you some extensive quotes from there, so what is kind of touched upon. But Darwin remains somehow sketchy about what you should actually learn from that. Then people have amassed evidence over the next decades, basically by finding examples where this seems to be the case, that similar species don't coexist easily. And it was about the turn of the century. Ulf mentioned Grinnell, and Grinnell in the 1904 paper apparently was the first to try to formulate this as a kind of general law. And I think it's interesting that around the same time they came up with a very similar idea in economics. And they said that competitors who produce the same product cannot coexist in the same market. This is an idea that arose around the same time. And I don't know whether the economist got this from the biologists or the ecologists from the economists or whether this was an independent development. But it's interesting to note these parallels. Anyway, so this discussion then continued into the 20th century. You've heard that Lotka worked on it, Volterra worked on it, other people worked on it. Gause was mentioned. In the 40s and 50s, we find a rather heated discussion about this, because the discussion was heated because there were plenty of examples, and people are very strongly believed that this was true, but there were also counterexamples. There's a lot of, and they haven't gone away, so this is why I pointed out, there are a lot of similar species that I believe to ecologically similar and in close contact, and apparently they do coexist. So Hardin, of course, already joined this discussion in 1950 in a book, 52, I believe, and in 1960 published his paper that was called The Competitive Exclusion Principle. And I think it's because he was the one who really tried to elevate this observation that was already there to the level of a principle. And I think it's interesting to somehow trace his ideas a little bit. First, let's look at his formulation of the principle. Complete competitors cannot coexist. You can tell from the nice alliteration and this elegant composition that he put a lot of thought into that. And he admits it himself when he writes them. The statement given above has been very carefully constructed. Every one of the four words is ambiguous. And you can, this was no, I mean, he did it on purpose, because he didn't want to describe reality, but he wanted to invite, to get people to think about, he wanted to invoke thought processes about this. So he wanted to become a guiding principle. And just as an example, so this complete competitor thing, what is a complete competitor? It gives two ideas, it occupies the same niche. This is not an easy idea in itself. We have heard a lot in this workshop about definition of niche and what this actually means. And the other thing is not easier. He said, occupy the same territory. I mean, this is kind of clear, you know, when one species is there and the other is far away, then clearly they are not competing. They are not regular. They're completely different things. And then they come close, and when they're in the same territory, they will compete. But, of course, it's immediately, so this is the one case here, yeah, this is the other. And of course, then you have the case where they overlap, and the problems already begin. What would you expect there? You don't know. And then if you go from the species level to the individual level, the problem becomes even, I mean, this is really a kind of weasel formulation then, because two species, two individuals by definition, are never exactly in the same place, right? They are somewhere in the area. When are they close enough to be considered in the same territory? It's leaves a lot of room for interpretation. This is, the hallmarks of a principle. You know, you need to bend your whole view of the world towards fitting the principle. So it's shaping your ideas here. And this is what he had in mind. So we could call it, some people call such things paradigms. And he says this very clearly. If species continue to coexist indefinitely, and this is the counterexample that he was well aware of, do you conclude that the principle is false? Not at all. So this is not, in his mind, not empirically falsifiable. You decided there must have been some subtle differences in the ecology that escaped you at first. And so he wanted this principle to be a kind of lens through which you see nature and through which you interpret everything that you see there. So let's see how this works in, or might work in practice. Let's assume we have a habitat here. It has some structure. I will explain a bit later what this structure here in this case is exactly, but I hope you agree that it has a certain natural, you know, feeling to it. This patchy thing. You know that there are, you've heard, you know, from personal walking around or from anecdotal reports that there are two sibling species found in this habitat. And here's one. And here's the other. You see that they are basically identical, except for minor differences in coloration. And so you send out your, and you want to know how they are distributed exactly. So you're going to send out your hordes of PhD students there, and you have to catch them and tag them and then put radio collars on them, whatnot. And so after some summers, you have kind of collected enough data to know where they are exactly found and bring it. And what you find after some averaging is that they are kind of distributed like this. And then you do this, repeat the same thing in the next decade or whatever the time horizon is here. And you'll find that this is a more or less stable distribution. So maybe some very minor fluctuations here in this overlapping range. You see that they're overlapping a little bit there. So that can be fluctuate. But this is basically what you find in subsequent investigation periods. What would you conclude about the importance of these colors? So if you take this exclusion principle to heart, as Hartman wanted you to, you would probably think that these colors somehow, you know, these green types may be more favored in this area. Because, you know, maybe this is an area where you have green grass and kind of reddish bushes, and there's a higher density of these reddish bushes here, so the red ones can kind of hide from their predators, and this green grass in the middle, and so the green ones kind of have an advantage there, or something like this. And but then you find that maybe there are no red bushes, so you would have to reconsider this, and well, there's probably green grass. Anyway. But this is data from models and not from empirical data. So I know exactly what these colors do, and I can tell you that they do nothing at all ecologically. These species are ecologically completely equivalent. And since this is a stochastic model, we can run the same model for, with different seeds, again to stabilization, and we may find the picture may look like this. So in another case, we might find this distribution, which is actually very similar to this. We still have, okay, the green ones in the middle. But then you may also find this. And again, this is then stationary. And here it's completely apparent that they have basically switched places. So what is going on here? And this is what I'm going to talk about now. And what is going on is sexual selection. You might have guessed already that this, you know, colors have something to do with that, and those are because I had the title already. Now, let me talk about a bit. How long are we in time? No, plenty of time. Good. Yeah, so we start with the reason why we're dragging sexual selection this at all is because this is the, what the counterexamples do here. So we have these species that have assumed to be ecologically very, very similar, but often they display rather differences in this either behavioral or signaling behavior, or discolorations and things like that. So this is actually, you can find plenty of examples in all that have more of this characteristic. And people, of course, this is not a new insight now. The time having is, this is an idea that is also around for at least 100 years or longer, probably all the way back to Darwin again. And people have tried to use sexual selection as a mechanism for that is kind of alternative to ecological speciation all the time. But there were kind of problems. Because the models that try to, and I think this modeling efforts really started with this Fisher's book in 1930. The first step is very clear. If females are choosy and prefer certain males, then they kind of form this mating pairs, mating groups. And the problem is, if these groups then compete for the same ecological niche, then one is gets extinct because of this competitive exclusion. This is what usually happens. Now, the same niche we don't want to touch because we say we want ecologically equivalent ones. But the same place, this is the other component. Is there a method by which these mating groups could become spatially separated? Because this would then save us. They would be in different locations, kept apart by this sexual selection drive. The question is, can we make this work? And so if these preferences are localized, now we get the same thing, but these mating groups are spatially segregated now. So the local, the females that are surrounded by males that they prefer and males that prefer certain females, and they kind of get spatially separated. And the problem is again, so this you had models like this in the early 80s around Lande and other people. The problem with this mating domains is in finite populations. So these mating domains are not anchored anywhere, right? They have these interfaces between them, and this, because if everything is kind of demographically fluctuating, it may happen that, you know, this interface gets a dent somewhere, so they squeeze out the one mating group that managed to go in there, squeezes out the other mating group, and or that one mating group just becomes so small that it's kind of crushed by the surrounding mating group. So in the end, the same thing happens. You don't get stable coexistence of these mating groups. The big question is, what ingredients do you need to make this mating domain stable? And it turns out now, after some investigation, there are two essential ingredients. The one is spatial variation in carrying capacity. So this is what this colors here were about. Dark color means high carrying capacity. White color means light color means low carrying capacity. So there is a variation in carrying capacity. Not in an ecological character, mind you, of this environment, just in carrying capacity. And the other ingredient that we need is mate search costs for females. So I talked about choosy females, or female choice model, which is a very common assumption. And of course, there are always costs of rarity for males. So if the male is in an area where nobody wants him, he has a fitness cost, apparently. But this is not a necessary assumption for females. For females can do two things. So if the preference means that if they have this red bunny and this green bunny here for choice, they would prefer one of them. But what happens if this preferred bunny is not here? There are two things that are basically one could that also probably happen in nature. The one thing is you go searching for Mr. Right, so to speak, and invest some time and effort to find him. You may eventually mate with somebody else, but you have wasted some energy there, some time. So you also this will result in some fitness cost. The other thing, of course, is you could just take the first one you find when you don't have the preferred one. In this case, you would not incur a fitness cost. So the case that we need here and that we can talk about is the case where the choosy females also incur a fitness cost to themselves by being choosy. And then, and with this we can now build our model. So those are the ingredients. The individuals have same ecology, but a different secondary sexual character. You know, those are these red and green display traits and the corresponding preference traits. We modeled this with a very simple genetic model here. So there are two loci. One is this display locus, one the preference locus. They're haploids and they're not linked. And at each locus, we have two alleles. The capital Q would be the red display. The small q would be the green display. Capital Q would be the preference for the red display. The small p would be the preference for the green display. And also, it's not a model of evolution, actually. We assume that the genetic variation randomly distributed in the population. Where this variation is coming from is another question. It could be immigration types or something. But here we're just looking at the kind of demographic consequences of that. And the environment is the other component, individuals in the environment. The environment as that is ecologically neutral, but we have this variation carrying capacity. I have shown you this one, which looks so nice and natural. But what we're actually using for most of the data that follows is a kind of, let's say, the C-theorist, this one. So we have just two peaks here and kind of two high carrying capacity peaks. And this is easier to analyze somehow than the other one, because it's easier to describe. And then we stuff the things in the model. So the model is individual-based, this red and green bunnies here. We have this continuous 2D space, this rectangle that you saw. And we have a discrete time model with non-overlapping generations. Again, this is not a necessary ingredient. In earlier investigations where the continuous time model was very much like this model that Ben Haller was talking about, or the well-known Tupelo-Tiekman 2003 model, which has basically the same results, but it's a runtime problem, basically. We had to do a lot of simulations until we found the right ingredients here. So we decided to switch to this discrete time scheduling, which is much faster, basically. Since we have this time steps, let's see what we do in the time steps. First, we move around. So there is a no directional preference drawn from a Gaussian 2D kernel. The mate and produce of, great, some important information here. Yeah, the preference is modeled by a factor. This is an old model that was also Kirk Beckwith 1982 does it and some other papers. So there is a factor by which the capital Qs prefer the capital P males and the small Q females prefer the small P males. It's wrong because the Q is a display trait and the P is the preference trait. I'm sorry. It should be the P females and the Q males in this case, of course, I mustn't make. Yeah, also preference, since everything is kind of localized here, preference attenuates with distance. If the preferred male is very far away, it's not preferred. It needs to be close by reasonably. So there's also a Gaussian attenuation of this mating preference. Yeah, and from all this, we can calculate the female fecundity, and this has these two basic components. The one is this local availability of preferred males. This is where this cost of female choosiness comes in. And the other thing is the local carrying capacity. This is where this carrying capacity structure comes in. Then offspring, there's a number of offspring points that are distributed to the females according to their fecundity. And then basically this offspring, the offspring then gets the values on their alleles from just by inheritance from the parents. And then they put to the mother location and replace the parent generation. Okay, I was talking about stability of mating domains and I claimed that they were stable. I will now explain what this actually means. So first, let's look at the case without, so here you see the environment, so it's a homogeneous environment. You have no variation in this carrying capacity here. We start as individuals, here is only plotted the display trait, but the preference state actually follows the display trait very closely after a short time. So it's enough to plot the display trait. They initially, they're randomly distributed and they have this kind of random trait. And after you see after 10 generations, you see this, what I said earlier, this formation of mating domains because of this choosiness. But it doesn't last long. You know? Here's the red, after 100 generations, the red domain already has come under pressure a lot and it's a little long and it's gone completely. How does this look with this carrying capacity peaks? Well, you see, same initial situation, but the types, they conquer the peak, so they play this kind of king of the hill game, and when they manage to conquer a peak, they stay there. And basically, this, you could run this for a very long time, as long as you can afford, and this picture will not change, really. I mean, you even see, you get these individuals all the time. Sometimes they come over there to the other domain and try the luck, so you have to see one there. But they cannot invade these domains because of these costs. Those were single realizations. Now, this is actually the main figure here. Let's look at this, how this looks when you average this over many, many simulations. And here I have to say, you see that the outcome of the short time is that they have conquered this carrying capacity peaks. Now, since we're now interested in coexistence, for the next results, we didn't start them at this initially random distribution because only in half of the cases they actually conquer these peaks, and the other half, it's one that manages to conquer both peaks. So only in this half of the cases where you actually get this both peaks conquered by different types, you have this coexistence, of course. So we start these next simulations with just the greens in the upper part and the reds in the lower part. And so this is how, no female preference, this is this factor alpha, this is the factor of the preference, no cost of choosiness, and here in the inset you see a kind of cut through the carrying capacity, no variation in carrying capacity. Initially they are, so this is another frequency of this Q display allele. As I said, the frequency of the preference allele follows this very closely. Initially it's half in the population, then you see this kind of wild oscillations, and finally it either takes over the population or it dies out. So in half and half of the cases. Of course, dying out means that the other allele, the small q, the red one, would win. So this is how they read the plot. If you see the stabilization, either 0 and 1, it means that one of the alleles has died out in the population. Now we add piece, step by step, we add things. So first we add female preference. Alpha 5 is already means a strong preference by a factor of 5 for this one type. No costs, no variation, carrying capacity. And it actually, what you see is it doesn't not only helps, it even kills them off quicker. So basically, if they have this preference already, this just hastens somehow the demise of the types that happens to be, I think it's probably the type that happens to be less frequent or something. Now you add either spatial variation here, which does nothing at all, as you can see compared to this case, or high costs. Okay, perfect, thank you. But no spatial variation. So the spatial variation by itself does nothing at all, as you can see, as compared to this case. But introducing costs does a little bit. So it actually, that's the button. It actually prolongs coexistence. So this is the mating domains get somehow more difficult to invade if the females cannot make it. Because the thing that happens when there's no cost to females, right, if a female gets into the opposite mating domain, then it just can invade this domain because it will mate with everybody there and it will spread its host enemy allele there and the domain will be destroyed from within This is not so easily possible in this case, and this is why you have longer coexistence. And finally, if you put in both things, and this is the spatial variation here, and the costs, you find this nice picture. And you will see that this is immediately qualitatively different from the other case. You don't have even this initial kind of attempts to somehow branch out. It's not there. You get this kind of stable, nice thing. And as I said, you can't run this out for many thousand generations, and this wouldn't change at all. So this is the basic result here. This is what coexistence means. Okay, I think you had, how many minutes do I have?
3 minutes.
Yeah, okay, I have two more plots. I don't want to talk about them in detail. They're about the robustness of this result. Maybe you want to ask questions about this later. Let me jump to the conclusions directly here to keep my time. So there was this belief which is coming from this competitive exclusion principle that coexistence of ecologically similar species is unlikely. However, if you have a situation where you have spatial variation in carrying capacity and mate search costs for females, then sexual selection can stabilize mating domains, can lead to a segregation of, first to a formation of these mated domains and then stabilize them. So this is doesn't happen in all the cases. It happens when one type, first by initial random chance, happens to capture one larger peak and the other happens to capture another large peak. This, of course, doesn't happen with certainty. This is an initial random thing. But if it happens, then sexual selection stabilizes this. And ultimately, I think one can say that both features are pretty common, actually. Most natural habitats probably have some variation in the carrying capacity, and this doesn't need to be very, very strong. I can look at these other plots I have that see that something like 10% can be enough to stabilize this, and 10% is not very much, really. And also, mate search costs in females. As I said, it's maybe not the case in all, but there are probably many examples where this is the case. And if you have both together, so which you have in many, I think, many real system, you have a completely new perspective here on how you can analyze these distributions. Because as you saw this earlier distribution that I think would, by a standard explanation, would immediately be interpreted as coming from some ecological differences. But now you see this could also come very well from the sexual selection in this case. Okay, with this I will close the main talk. Thank you for your attention.
We have time for some questions.
Ooh. I think a remark that I think is mating cost for females is quite analogous to limited dispersal, because it does the same thing in your model that limits. So if it's costly to search long for the mate, then it's the same as you have limited dispersal. And we know already that limited dispersal potential can enable coexistence. So it's a nice analogy.
Yeah, but of course we don't, I mean, heterogeneous environment, usually people think of some ecologically heterogeneity, right? And then, of course, if you have limited dispersal, then you get this kind of locally adapted groups that kind of can remain stable.
Just heterogeneity in terms of resource availability, which you can.
Yeah.
And then I saw the next one I saw was over there, and then there was somebody over here. So, okay, so then behind, and then I think that's probably who's done something. So first of all, you?
Me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't see him.
First to remark, this reminds me a lot about the stability of the hybrid zones. Maybe you should look into that literature, unless you haven't done so already. Another thing is sure, there's coexistence, but somehow locally still the competitive exclusion principle still is at work, because they don't exist in the same place, they just exist in the same area somehow.
Yeah, this is why I made some comments about this spatial structure requirement of the exclusion principle. I mean, you have seen they can start out in the same area. This segregation is an internally driven thing. And I mean, they can get quite around also in this area. So they have dispersal, and you find all the time, you find individuals from the one type getting into the other domain, just they don't make it there. So if you were to go out in the field and catch them, you would always find types of... So they're trying to move in, and if the other domain weren't there, they would immediately move over and take this place. So I think in this sense, it's kind of the same environment, because they could immediately colonize if it were available.
Okay, and then Yuri, and then there are lots of others who want to talk, but I think we should wait until after.
So Yuri. You mentioned taking new perspectives about coexistence. Now, actually, to me, it would seem, and this kind of connects with both Gabriela's and Jürgen's perspective, that taking the regulating factor thinking actually helps understand this situation, because what you have here is that if the spatial distribution is right, then because of the search cost to the females, there's an effective self-regulation of the population. They kind of impose a limit on their own growth compared to imposing a limit on the other. So in this sense, you effectively ecologically segregate. And if you take this generic, you know, regulating factor formalism, which you might like or might not, precisely because it's overgenerality, this fits in very well, that you basically create separate regulating factors which regulate this population separately.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, ecologically, local carrying capacity means that, of course, you have basically local regulation. But, I mean, that's a trivial point. But I think the point here is that they are not limited to these positions where they are. They would immediately move over if they could.